Now on BBC Radio 4, Cathy Fitzgerald explores the terror and sheer delight of plunging into the unknown. In this week's Something Understood, jump.
I'm 10,000 feet above the earth, sitting on the grubby floor of a tiny metal plane. I press my back hard to the hull. A man I've only just met is unhooking a canvas square to make an opening to the sky just across from me. The air rushes in. The plane tips. He tells me to move, to sit on the edge. I'm not breathing, and there's no thinking going on. I slide across the floor. Somehow I manage to sit in the doorway. Half in, half out, muscles tense. Just me and a wide blue sky. And then I jump. The wind's coming at me, my eyes are shut, I'm screaming, and it's the loudest, freest scream of my life. Diablo Rojo by Rodrigo y Gabriela, a song inspired by the dips and corkscrews of a roller coaster. What is it about that lurching sensation in the pit of our stomach that makes us feel so alive? The fear, the rush. We jump out of our heads and into our bodies, abandon daydreams about past and future for the visceral charge of right here, right now. We've all felt it, that itch in the soul, the desire not to watch, but to be part of the game, for life to be bigger, richer, more. Some jumps are big, other jumps are small. Some days you change your life, other days you just change your hair. And every now and again, you take the biggest risk of them all. You get up to dance. Ladies and gentlemen, the pilot has switched off the fasten seatbelt sign. Please don't stay in your seats.
Shake, Sinora, shake your body liner. Shake, 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 Sinora, shake it all the time. Work, 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 Sinora, work your body liner. Work, 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 Sinora, work it all the time. My girl's name is Sonora, I tell your friends I adore her. And when she dances, oh brother, she's a hurricane in all kinds of weather. Jump in the line, rock your body on time. Okay, I believe you. Jump in the line, rock your body on time. Okay, I believe you. Jump in the line, rock your body on time. Okay, I believe you. Jump in the line, rock your body on time.
Harry Belafonte with Jump in the Line. Jumping requires faith, if only for a moment, in your own instincts and the abundance of the world. Faith that if you don't wind up where you expect, you will, perhaps a few jumps down the line, wind up where you belong. It's to square up to the unknown, with only a travelling cloak and a broadsword, and to say, in Elvish, judging by the metaphor, bring it on. A lucky few were born with such freewheeling courage. I think of them as white rabbits. They won't necessarily lead you somewhere safe, but they'll always lead you somewhere new. I have to follow one of my favourite white rabbits, breathless, daring, mad cat Maud Parrish, on the printed page. She died back in 1976, but her writing is some of the most alive I've ever read. An American adventurer, she left behind a memoir, 9 pounds of luggage, that tells how she worked as a dancing girl in Dawson City, ran a gambling den in Peking, and wound up circling the world no fewer than 16 times. Here she is in the 1890s, trapped in an unhappy marriage and making plans.
I knew I couldn't go back to the husband the judge had tied me to legally, and to me that meant I couldn't live in San Francisco. Wanderlust can be the most glorious thing in the world sometimes, but when it gnaws and pricks at your innards, especially in spring, with your hands and feet tied, it's awful. So I left, without telling a soul. I had a little money and my banjo. I didn't know what I'd do when the money ran out. But I went anyway to Seattle, and quick as a wink, I got passage on a boat for Alaska. The air was full of the Klondike. The lure of adventure pulled me aboard, and the tied-down feeling stayed ashore. Here I saw people I could understand. Here were those who had filled my imagination, who had lived and travelled in my mental map of old Mother Earth. Imagination is a grand, stimulating cocktail, but to find reality is the full-course dinner with champagne. Those miners, prospectors, contractors, adventurers, gamblers, those other mysterious characters whose business it would be difficult to figure, suited my dream. No matter who they were or where they were from, both old and young, had the spirit I admired. From there, by dog team, 500 miles to Dawson, dogs and people were bursting to get into that capital of the frozen Northland. I arrived with but $10, but Mr. Rockefeller himself never felt richer. In that exhilarating atmosphere, I'd have bet I could clear the mountains with a hop, skip and jump. The very air was electric, and the people were electric too, 100% alive, whatever else ailed them.
Maud Parrish, who rarely stood still, and lived, really lived, to the age of 98. Pulling out the tablecloth from under life's crockery is dangerous. Few of us have the nerve to risk the smash until we realise we just can't go on in the same old way. Hermann Hesse describes reaching this point in his tiny, beautiful book, Wandering. In a series of essays, poems and sketches, he meditates on his attempt to begin a new life after a period of depression. His words are a reminder of the simple joy we can find in the world, in those times when how we live is a true reflection of who we are. Walking in the Alps, he salutes a farmhouse as he goes by.
Good luck to the man who owns this place, the man who works it, the faithful, the virtuous. I can love him, I can revere him, I can envy him. But I have wasted half my life trying to live his life. I wanted to be something that I was not. I am a nomad and not a farmer, a man who searches and not a man who keeps. A long time I castigated myself before gods and laws, which were only idols for me. I increased the world's guilt and anguish by doing violence to myself, by not daring to walk toward my own salvation. The way to salvation leads neither to the left nor the right. It leads into your own heart, and there alone is God, and there alone is peace. I smile, and not only with my mouth. I smile with my soul, with my eyes, with my whole skin, and I offer these countrysides whose fragrances drift up to me, different senses than those I had before, more delicate, more silent, more finely honed. My yearning no longer paints dreamy colours across the veiled distances. My eyes are satisfied with what exists because they have learned to see. I am alone, and I don't suffer from my loneliness. I don't want life to be anything other than what it is. I am ready to let myself be baked in the sun till I am done. Thoughts and sorrows seem to have remained on the other side of the mountains. Here, there are no problems. Mere existence needs no justification. Thinking becomes a game. A person discovers the world is beautiful and life is brief. I stretch out my legs in the grass, and I wish they could be longer.
Thank you.
Hermann Hesse, followed with a hop, skip and a jump by Artie Shaw. Often we attach our desire to jump to another person, wanting things to be different, to discover who we are before it's too late. We loiter by the edge of the precipice, waiting to fall in love, for someone else to say, why not? Why not dance more? Why not learn the trumpet? Why not give up everything to fly the trapeze? In that moment of intense vulnerability, our sense of identity is unusually molten, and we have a precious chance to recast ourselves in new ways. It's easier to jump when you're holding someone's hand. Here's an extract from a short story by Jeanette Winterson, The White Room.
We had met a week before in a restaurant, and I knew something was changing when I was envious of the salt cellar. You were playing with the neck of the salt cellar while we talked. My neck tingled. Do you like Japanese food? Yes, I said, yes. Do you go to the theatre? Yes, I said, yes. Should we go and see a film? And I'm thinking, should we go and see? Should we go? Should we? Wondering if we should, I knew we would, with an inevitability that felt like fate, which is dangerous because life is not fate. Life is choice. It is easier if things happen to us, but truer that we happen to things. Slightest accidents open up new worlds. It had been raining, and someone had taken my umbrella. I had to shelter under yours, bodies close together, respectably close. Drops of rain fell from the downturned nylon edges of our stripy canopy. Each was a complete world, new and untried, a crystal ball that held the future we would choose. Let them fall. There are so many chances, so many worlds pouring down on us. Like most people, I take no notice and let them flow away, eons breaking back into the universes where they were made. We are universes dripping with worlds. I have no choice, is what I usually say. Not true. What happens next has no practical purpose. What happens next is not sensible or industrious. I have arrived at the borders of common sense, and either I turn back to my own land, or I cross into a place where different laws prevail. The rain has fallen all night, and I'm out of my depth. What did you say? My body is a river deep enough for diving. Swim in me. What happens if I don't turn back? What happens if I choose the river? My heart is beating. I'm leaning over the water, but it's not my own reflection that I see. The water is too troubled for that. What I see is the world turned upside down, a watery city, the mirror of the solid world that I have now. But everything solid is turning into its watery equivalent. There is nothing to hold on to. I shall have to let go. There is something to hold on to. You have put out your hand. For the first time, I touch your skin, skin close enough for grafting. Graft this moment onto time and take it with us when the clock starts ticking again, which will happen very soon. Time stops rarely and not for long. The door opens, but no one can say when. Make love to me.
Music full of wanting and waiting. Antiphon by Hidden Orchestra. No matter how much we want to think life's bowling us over, it's always, at some level, a choice. But when we've decided, when we know we're going to act, oh, the power and the glory. We are so mighty, so high. It's your heart pounding. It's the boarding pass clutched in your hand. It's the second, the long, tense second, when you lean in for the kiss. It's intoxicating to test your mettle and realise you've got the nerve. The bottle to face the unknown. Indignities, discomfort, perhaps even getting what you want. But what happens if you sidle up to the precipice and the world starts to swim? Sometimes it's only when we get right to the edge that we realise we don't have the nerve. We look down and, like Jimmy Stewart in Vertigo, things swirl and we're overwhelmed by fear. This is Bernard Herrmann's soundtrack to Hitchcock's famous film about a detective with no head for heights. What if we jump and only the rocks are waiting? What if we dive and there are weeds and dark water under the waves? Suddenly everything we wanted to leave behind becomes something we're frightened to lose. The safety of home can exert a particularly powerful countertow. We long to throw over its cushions and comforts to escape its stifling air. But those four sturdy walls keep us safe, keep the wolves at bay. That's the kind of old magic that it's hard to ignore. Poised on the threshold, Evelyn, the young heroine of one of the short stories in James Joyce's Dubliners, feels its pull.
She sat at the window, watching the evening invade the avenue. She had consented to go away, to leave her home. She would not be treated as her mother had been. Even now, though she was over 19, she sometimes felt herself in danger of her father's violence. When they were growing up, he had never gone for her like he used to go for Harry and Ernest, because she was a girl. But latterly, he had begun to threaten her and say what he would do to her only for her dead mother's sake. She was about to explore another life with Frank. Frank was very kind, manly, open-hearted. She was to go away with him by the night boat to be his wife and to live with him in Buenos Aires, where he had a home waiting for her. He had tales of distant countries. He had sailed through the Straits of Magellan, and he told her stories of the terrible Patagonians. Of course, her father had found out the affair and had forbidden her to have anything to say to him. "I know these sailor chaps," he said. Her father was becoming old lately, she noticed. He would miss her. Not long before, when she had been laid up for a day, he had read her out a ghost story and made toast for her at the fire. Another day, when their mother was alive, they had all gone for a picnic to the Hill of Howth. She remembered her father putting on her mother's bonnet to make the children laugh. She stood among the swaying crowd in the station at the North Wall. Frank held her hand, and she knew that he was speaking to her, saying something about the passage over and over again. The boat blew a long, mournful whistle into the mist. If she went, tomorrow she would be on the sea with him, steaming towards Buenos Aires. Her distress awoke a nausea in her body, and she kept moving her lips in silent, fervent prayer. A bell clanged upon her heart. She felt him seize her hand. "Come." All the seas of the world tumbled about her heart. He was drawing her into them. He would drown her. she gripped with both hands at the iron railing. Come. No, 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 it was impossible. Her hands clutched the iron in frenzy. Amid the seas, she sent a cry of anguish. Evelyn, Evie. He rushed beyond the barrier and called to her to follow. He was shouted at to go on, but he still called to her. She set her white face to him, passive, like a helpless animal. Her eyes gave him no sign of love or farewell or recognition.
Nick Cave and Warren Ellis. Falling. Sometimes we don't jump because we've grown too wise, finally learned to look before we leap. Sometimes we already have a good hand and we choose to stick, not to twist. Sometimes it's expectation, obligation, love that holds us back from the edge. We squeeze ourselves into lives that are just a little smaller than we are. And if we're lucky, we don't notice where they pinch. The great ode to hesitation and resignation is T.S. Eliot's The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, with its eponymous hero, always on the brink.
Do I dare disturb the universe? In a minute there is time for decisions and revisions which a minute will reverse. And the afternoon, the evening sleeps so peacefully, smoothed by long fingers, asleep, tired, or it malingers, stretched on the floor here beside you and me. Should I, after tea and cakes and ices, have the strength to force the moment to its crisis? But though I have wept and fasted, wept and prayed, though I have seen my head grown slightly bald, brought in upon a platter, I am no prophet, and here's no great matter. I have seen the moment of my greatness flicker, and I have seen the eternal footman hold my coat and snicker. And in short, I was afraid. And would it have been worth it after all? After the cups, the marmalade, the tea, among the porcelain, among some talk of you and me, would it have been worthwhile to have bitten off the matter with a smile, to have squeezed the universe into a ball, to roll it towards some overwhelming question, to say, I am Lazarus, come from the dead, come back to tell you all, I shall tell you all. If one, settling a pillow by her head, should say, that is not what I meant at all. That is not it at all. No, I am not Prince Hamlet, nor was meant to be. I'm an attendant lord, one that will do to swell a progress, start a scene or two, advise the prince, no doubt an easy tool, deferential, glad to be of use, politic, cautious and meticulous, full of high sentence, but a bit obtuse. At times, indeed, almost ridiculous, almost at times, the fool. I grow old. I grow old. I shall wear the bottoms of my trousers rolled. Shall I part my hair behind? Do I dare to eat a peach? I shall wear white flannel trousers and walk upon the beach. I have heard the mermaids singing, each to each. I do not think they will sing to me.
I remember reading Eliot's poem for the first time, fourth period just before lunch, Electric lights in the classroom because of the rain. Being a melancholy teenager, I loved its grey hopelessness, Prufrock's weary acceptance of his fate. How should we, so small, dare disturb the universe? But I grow old. And as I do, I increasingly think of Eliot's hero as a cautionary figure. I'm more interested in hope than hopelessness now, movement rather than paralysis. Acceptance isn't the end of the story, it's the beginning of a whole new tale. So with apologies to T.S. Eliot, I like to believe that after a respectable time, and when he knows we're not looking, J. Alfred will shrug his shoulders, eat the peach, and dive in for a swim.
Where are you?
Snow Lake, Yukon. On an island where I can see mountains and blue sky.
Megan Perry is a broadcaster and writer living in the Yukon Territory. She recorded this audio postcard with a friend. It's called Swimming in Snafu.
What's the water like?
Well, it's very clear, but I would have to say a little cold.
What are you wearing?
Not a stitch.
And what's your next move?
I'm going to dunk right in. Right in, like dive like a mermaid. Okay. Here we go.
It's a lesson I'll have to learn and relearn all my life. But the truth is, if we don't hug our losses too closely, and we don't mind, now and again, looking a fool, there's always more. More friends, more love, more dancing. All we have to do is jump.
Something Understood was presented by Cathy Fitzgerald and included readings by Emma Fielding and Jonathan Keeble. The producer was Eleanor McDowell, and it was a Falling Tree production for BBC Radio 4.